start again. I'm right at the beginning. Incremental from 100 words a minute. Ready? The late Lord Darling, who was more commonly known as Mr. Justice Darling, once wrote a book in which he pointed out that although it is true that the accused person is presumed to be innocent until he is proved to be guilty, nevertheless, he suffers this embarrassment that he enters the court through a hole in the floor, he stands in the dock, and his address is presumably the county jail. But while that is so common, nevertheless, the protection of the citizen is very real indeed. Now, observe what a responsibility lies upon our shoulders to do our work properly. One of the things that we must always remember is this, that our very existence as verbatim reporters rests upon our maintaining and retaining the confidence of the judges. As long as the judges have confidence in us, we are all right. But if through negligence or ignorance or lack of training we should lose that confidence, then it would be the end of us. They would find some other way of getting our work done, and we should be like Othello, our occupation gone. When a shorthand writer produces a bad transcript, and between you and me, I believe there are some, it does not merely injure him, but it injures everybody who is a shorthand writer. I was reporting a judgment on one occasion, or summing up, of the late Mr. Justice Avery. He had had great experience of transcripts, and I may say that any shorthand writer who misreported him ought to suffer the fate of the prophet Ezekiel and be made to eat his own notebook, because nobody in the world was easier to report than Mr. Justice Avery. But I thought it was rather hard when he said, "You will never know whether you are being reported accurately." I do not know whether the shorthand writer who is reporting me now is doing so accurately. I thought it was a little hard, and I thought then that perhaps the sins of others had been visited upon my head. I want to say to you who are trainees that it is your duty to uphold the standards of accuracy upon which, as I say, our very existence depends. There is another difficulty that you will find, and that is that the work is very irregular. There are times of very great stress, peak periods when there is an enormous amount of work to be done and not enough people to do it, and there are other times when there is very little work to do. There are the vacations. There is the fact that on Monday, three judges may be sitting in the Court of Criminal Appeal and only one shorthand writer required for the three of them, while on the next day, those three judges, each sitting in their own court, and at least one shorthand writer required for each court, and if they are heavy cases, two or three, perhaps even four. So that, you see, we are called upon at one time to give all of our energy and to do as much work as we possibly can, and at another time, We are not wanted at the moment. It is the irregular distribution of our work which makes it so trying. As the bald-headed economist said when shaving himself, it is a problem not of production, but of distribution. If I may tell you another of my experiences, I have had the experience of taking shorthand notes at a lecture, and in the middle of the lecture, all the lights have been turned out so that the people might see a film to illustrate the remarks of the lecturer, and then I have had to sit and write in the dark. It is difficult to write in the dark, but I have found it even more difficult sometimes to read it afterwards in the light. Having made those introductory remarks, I want to make a few suggestions as to what should be done by people who hope to become really efficient shorthand writers. It is not a thing which is beyond the capacity of human beings. Some of my colleagues have done it. The first thing that you have to be able to do is to write shorthand. When I say that, I really mean it. I mean to write shorthand properly. Lots and lots of people say, and apparently believe, that they write shorthand when their shorthand is really dreadful. Not 1% of the people who write shorthand do it properly. But if you are going to be a verbatim shorthand writer, if you are going to write at the speeds at which the discussion and cross-examination and all that sort of thing goes on, you have to write shorthand correctly. What I think is this. I do not know whether my colleagues will agree with me, but I think the first thing you have to do is write shorthand correctly and then try for speed after you have got the accuracy. Write your shorthand slowly but accurately, and when you have got it written really accurately, you need not trouble about speed, because that will come to you automatically without any trouble at all, as a mere matter of practice. There are many people who try to do it the other way round. They try to get the speed first, and then they try to get accuracy afterwards. That is a procedure which is preposterous. And I use that much abused term in its precise meaning, because I take it that the word preposterous means doing things in the wrong order. And if you try to write fast before you can write accurately, you are merely stamping upon your mind a wrong method of doing it, with the result that if you are going to be a good shorthand writer, you have got to get that out of your mind again. One of the great problems and difficulties in all education is that so many people learn the wrong way first, and they have to get rid of that. It is much easier to put things down on a clean white sheet than it is to put them down upon a sort of palimpsest of mistaken ideas and wrong methods. So that is the first suggestion that I have to make to you. The next thing is this, that shorthand must be written shortly. If you write outlines at unnecessary length, that is not merely a work of supererogation, and I do not object to it on the theological, but rather on practical grounds. There are people who call themselves shorthand writers who say, "Now I am going to write this out in full, and if I do that, I shall not make a mistake, because it will be written so fully that I cannot possibly make a mistake." But that idea, I can assure you, is a snare and illusion. If you are trying to take a shorthand note of Sir Walter Monckton in full song, either you write it shortly or you do not write it at all. And my experience is this, and I think every experienced shorthand writer will bear me out, that if you write a thing correctly shortly, you can read it, and there is less likelihood of making a mistake than if you have written it at length. If you took the same amount of time to write a thing shortly as to write at length, I should still say it was a good thing to write it shortly. Of course, these things are not quite as so easy as they seem, and the true cunning of the experienced shorthand writer is that he knows the things that you can do and the things that you cannot do. Because if we write two things short, different things shortly, and then find when you are transcribing that you do not know which is which. You are fairly in the cart. You must not write anything in a way which may be clashed with anything else. The experienced man, the man who does not understand these things, of course, would make those mistakes, but the experienced man does not. He knows what he can write and what he cannot write, and he knows what will clash and what will not clash. I'm glad to see that my friend Mr. Hunter is going to talk to you on that subject, and as he is not here this afternoon, I can say something about him which he will not hear, and so will take no notice of, and that is this, that there is probably, I should think, nobody in the wide world who is better qualified to speak to you on that subject than he is. He has, of course, vast experience, and he has an ingenuity that is simply diabolical. I could spend a pleasant half hour here with a blackboard and a piece of chalk telling you of the little shortcuts that I myself have invented, but I have not brought a blackboard here, because Mr. Hunter tells me that he is going to do that, and he is going to tell you about these things. You must be very careful to be here on that occasion. Whatever happens, get here on Monday, 21 October. Get here, though the heavens fall, and you have to scramble over the debris. Bring a notebook with you, copy out all his ideas, exploit his ability and his brain to the utmost, and you will find that it will help you through your career to have his valuable advice on these matters, which he will so freely and so kindly give to you on that day. Of course, there is one thing that he cannot do for you, and that is this. We shorthand writers find continual variation in the subject matter upon which we are reporting. If we reported the same subject all the time, of course we could invent all sorts of delightful things, and when it does happen that the case goes on for weeks or months, as they sometimes do, it is wonderful what you can invent, how shortly you can write it. But what usually happens in practice is that on one day you are reporting a running down case, on another day it is burglary, and on another day a patent action, and so you have got to have the ingenuity to think out shortcuts as you go along, and you will need them. You will need every one of them. While I am upon that, it's a good idea, if you are not going to transcribe your notes immediately, and perhaps even if you are, to write those shortcuts down on the bottom of the page and make a note that so-and-so equals so-and-so, because if you do not transcribe your notes until weeks or months afterwards, you may forget. And you have got to be very careful not to be landed in that way. It is very easy to be caught on those things. As I say, these things look easier than they are. They require ingenuity, but I will tell you some expressions that are continually occurring. Every politician today, no matter what may be his political party, seems to find it impossible to make a speech without talking about organisation, reorganisation, and rehabilitation. As Mr. Hunter is not here, I could say this to you. When he gives you his lecture, you might ask him how he writes those words, because it is absolutely essential when you write organisation not to have all those awkward little corners that come out in the outlines that they give you in Mr. Pittman's books, because that will not do at all. All these things have got to be written shortly. When you get to cross-examination, there are various expressions which are occurring all the time. Expressions like, I suggest to you, I put it to you, I understand you to say, that is right, is it not, and so on. An enormous number of questions include those words, and there are methods, which no doubt Mr. Hunter will tell you of, writing those things, and you can write them immensely faster than anybody can even utter them. You have got to get those things fully into your mind so that you can deal with all of them without hesitation when they occur, and you will be really amazed at the rapid cross-examination that you can get down, because a lot of it is the same thing over and over and over again. Another thing that I should like you to ask Mr. Hunter is, how does he write in my submission, in my respectful submission? That is an expression which is continually occurring in legal argument. I now come to my next point, and that is this. His Lordship has mentioned it, and it is an obvious thing which every shorthand writer knows, and I was very much impressed when the Honourable Mr. Justice Atkinson mentioned it to you. It is, do not write this stuff down mechanically, because you are not a mechanic. You are, at any rate, a craftsman, if you are not a professional man. You are following a highly skilled craft, and you are not a mechanic. You are not just writing down what he said, regardless of the meaning of it. In the course of my work, people have come to me and they ask me about my work, people who do not know anything about it. And they often say to me, I suppose you write it all down mechanically, and you do not follow the sense of it at all. They think that, but of course, unless you are going to follow the sense of the matter that you are reporting, you cannot possibly report it correctly. That cannot be done, and the reason why these silly mistakes occur is that people take things down mechanically, and they do not think about what they are doing. You know, Mr. Justice Atkinson had that at the back of his mind all the time. He put it in a very kindly way, I thought, because he is a kindly gentleman. But at the back of his mind, he obviously had recollections of having seen some mistakes in transcripts that had been before him, and you could see that he was carefully thinking about that sort of thing. We have to be very careful about those matters. There is a story told, of course it is completely untrue, about a politician who said, ladies and gentlemen, what we have to face is a double lie in the shape of a half-truth. I expect he was thinking of the words of Tennyson, the truth that is only half-truth is ever the blackest of lies. But he said, what we have to face is a double lie in the shape of half-truth. And the reporter reported him as saying, what we have to face is a double eye in the shape of a half-tooth. From the point of view of hearing, you could not really blame the reporter for that, because it is very difficult to hear the difference between a double lie and a double I. They sound very much alike, and there is not much difference between the sound of truth and tooth. You could not blame him for that, but where he was to blame was that he ought to have seen the sense of the thing. He ought to have followed it and understood it, and if he had applied his mind to it, he would never have made such a silly mistake. If you send a transcript with something like that in it, I do not say that it stigmatizes you, but it certainly categorizes you. They know what you are. They know that you are a person without any common sense and without any intelligence and without any education. And if they think that we shorthand writers are people like that, then I say that is the end of us, because at the present moment we are face to face with very severe competition. We have got to stand up to it, and if we stand up to it, we shall succeed, and if we do not, we shall go down. Then, of course, there is the problem of general education. You have to have a good general education and a general knowledge of things. You do not require a very deep knowledge. You do not require to know names and words any better than to be able just to recognize them and to look them up. There is a story told, and it is another of these stories, which is probably altogether untrue, but it does not matter whether it is true or not, because my purpose in telling it is purely exegetical. The story is that the recent Labour Party conference at Bournemouth, the Prime Minister referred to somebody as the Carno who organised a socialist victory in the general election. Of course, he was referring to the Frenchman Carno, the great military genius who organised the armies of Napoleon. That was the man to whom he referred, but the story is told that a young reporter turned to somebody and said, what on earth has Fred Carno got to do with it? Perhaps that was a joke and he did not really mean it. But supposing somebody referred to Carno and you spelled the name K-A-R-N-O, it would be rather shocking, would it not? So you have to have that knowledge. Then you have to have a knowledge of ancient mythology. You want to know Greek mythology. People do not talk about that so much as they used to do, and I do not think that barristers today have quite the classical education that barristers used to have, but the old Greek mythology still comes out sometimes, even today. It still lives, and it is some of the greatest wisdom that the world has ever known. I myself always sympathise very deeply with the Lady Cassandra, who had the power of prophecy, but unfortunately it was no use to her, because nobody ever believed her prophecies. That is the sort of stuff that comes out sometimes. I have had references to the shirt of Nessus and to the bed of Procrustes, and all those things must be known, at any rate sufficiently well, for the shorthand writer to be able to recognise them. Then there is the problem of Latin. I remember that on one occasion I was reporting Mr. H.G. Robertson, and I went to him afterwards and I said, I did not recognise that Latin phrase you used. He said it was not Latin, it was Greek, and thereupon he wrote it down for me in Greek characters. Then I said to him, I have not got any Greek letters on my typewriter, and he wrote it down in English form for me. You will find that barristers are kindly people, and they will help you all that they reasonably can. But if you have learned Latin at school, you will find that the lawyer's Latin is a little confusing, because they pronounce it in the old-fashioned way. Of course, in the old days, the ancient Romans, they had no gramophones. William Shakespeare was under the impression that they had striking clocks that was a complete mistake on his part, because they had nothing of the kind. But certainly they had no gramophones, and therefore we cannot have a gramophone record and see what the Romans said and how they said it. You will remember what Julius Caesar said on a certain memorable occasion, Veni, Vidi, Vici. They tell me now that he did not say anything of the sort, but we do know that there is Latin poetry, and that the length of the syllable has to fit the Latin poetry. Probably in the way in which you were taught to pronounce it at school was the correct way, and you will find it difficult, if you learned Latin at school, to follow lawyers' ways of pronouncing it. But at the same time, you have to know it and be able to recognise it and to know the familiar Latin tags. They do not take very long to learn, and there is not really very much of them to learn, but I am afraid that many people do not know them. As a matter of fact, there is a great excuse for using Latin terms, because if you use the ordinary words, English words, for expressions which have technical meaning, the general public are apt to think that they know what they mean, when they do not really know what they mean at all, and therefore perhaps it is better, for example, to say ultra vires than beyond the powers. As a digression for a moment, I may tell you this, that in the course of your lives you will probably find yourselves going to meetings and conferences of organisations of various kinds, and there you are, shorthand writer, and you are the only person in that hall among all those people who is not a member of the organisation. I am constantly having that experience, and it is a rather remarkable one. You are the only foreigner, as it were, who is in that room, and that reminds me of a story that I should like to tell you by way of diversion, so that you will not find this talk of mine too tedious. The story is that of a shorthand writer who went to a religious revivalist meeting. The preacher delivered a powerful oration which had the desired result of causing many members of the audience to resolve that in future they would endeavour to lead a better life. When he had concluded his general address, he descended from the platform and moved among the congregation, speaking to one here and one there, supplementing his general remarks by a more personal appeal, and as he did so, in due course, he came to the shorthand writer. The shorthand writer was a young man, and he was sitting with his head bent over his notebook trying to read his shorthand notes. But the preacher, not understanding this, thought it was a rather devout attitude. So he touched the young man gently on the shoulder and said to him, "My friend, are you saved?" The young man looked up in astonishment and said, "I am the reporter." "Oh," said the preacher, "I beg your pardon." And with that he moved away. I have told you that little story because it illustrates the peculiar experience which I have so often had from finding myself in a body of people, the only person there who was not a member of their organisation. I have made some notes which I have here, and I find that I have not got through about a tenth of them, and I am afraid that my time is nearly exhausted. But I should just like to say one thing about examinations. When you have become qualified, it will be a great advantage to you to become a member of the Institute of Shorthand Writers, and in order to do that, you must pass an examination. Of course, I know that everybody sympathises with people who are being examined. Naturally, they do. I expect you all know the story of the young man who was going in for a law examination. He was rather doubtful as to whether he would pass the examination. So he wrote to the benchers of the inn and said, "I have been studying the law, and I have discovered that it is a principle of the law of England that every man is presumed to know the law. That being so, I suggest that it is unnecessary for me to sit this examination, and I might be presumed to have passed it." The benchers, taking him at his own vein, perhaps remembering the words of Solomon, "Answer a fool according to his folly," wrote back and said that of course there was such a presumption of law, but it might be rebutted by the examiners in the examination. Thereupon the young man wrote back again and said that he had studied the matter further, and he discovered that there were two kinds of presumption of law, some of which were rebuttable and some of which were not, so that everybody knows the law is not rebuttable. Thereupon the benchers of the inn, being completely cornered, did what people in authority sometimes do when they are in difficulties and refuse to discuss the matter any further. You are not presumed to know shorthand, and I want you, if you will, to have some sympathy with the examiners. I am not an examiner at the present moment, but I have been one, and I can tell you that the examiners are kindly people, in spite of the harsh nature of the duties which they have to discharge, and I can assure you of one thing, and that is that the examiners want to pass you. They do not want to keep you out, and they want to get you in, and if they can pass you, they will. But, of course, the examination is not a mere form. It is a serious matter, and an examiner cannot honestly pass people who do not, as he thinks, come up to the standard which is required. The form in which we put it is that the candidate is not competent, but that he has failed to satisfy the examiners that he is a competent shorthand writer. That is rather an ingenious way of putting it, as I always think, though I did not invent it. I hope you will not have any feeling against examiners who are only trying to do their best to help you. If you do pass, you will experience a considerable increase in your income. It will increase when people know that you are a member of the Institute. If you do not succeed, I want to say this, that we in the Institute always try to keep these things secret. The fact that a candidate has applied for examination is kept secret as far as possible, and as a matter of fact, he is usually the person who lets it out. If you do apply, you have to get two members to support your application, but I suggest that you do not tell anybody else about it, but to keep it quiet, and then if you fail, people will not know about it, and we on our part will try to keep it as quiet as we can. But if you do not succeed, do not let that dishearten you, but try again next year. You are perfectly welcome to try again, and in fact, the examiners frequently invite unsuccessful candidates to do so. I would not advise you to apply for membership of the Institute and to be examined if you think you are going to fail. I would not advise you to apply unless you really think you are going to succeed. But do not be nervous of failure. It will not do much harm because you can apply again the next year. And I would suggest that you should try not to let anything get you rattled. There are a number of things, other things, that I wanted to say to you, but I just want to say one thing in conclusion. I've had to leave out so many things that I wanted to say to you this evening, but there is one last thing that I do want to say, if you will bear with me for a moment. You will no doubt forget many of the things that I have said this evening, if you have not already done so, but what I'm now going to say I want to ask you most earnestly to remember, and that is this. We shorthand writers are members of a fraternity. We cooperate, and we assist one another, and we stand by one another. I do hope you will always remember that, that you have the right to turn to another shorthand writer and expect him to help you if you are in difficulties, and on the other hand, it is your duty to help him when you can. You can help him in many ways. If you are taking a case and it is found to be a heavy case and more than one shorthand writer is wanted on it and they bring in another man, do not forget that he knows nothing at all about the case, and if you can make a list of names or anything of that sort, give him a few hints as to what the matter is about. It would be of great assistance to him. Then there is the problem of borrowing documents. Do not go and take all the documents and leave none for him. Do try and cooperate with your colleagues, because that is the only way in which our work can be carried out smoothly and effectively. With those words, I close.